Welcome to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders, hosted by Mike Tsakopoulos and produced by the American Association for Physician Leadership.
Leaders come from all backgrounds. Those backgrounds influence, impact, and inform the characteristics of leaders. Often, leaders that come from less traditional backgrounds pave the way for others. Today, we will meet one of those leaders whose atypical background serves as a hopeful path for others. Next on Sound Practice. My guest today is Malaika Grayson. Dr. Grayson holds a PhD in mechanical engineering from Cornell University. She is the author of Hooded, A Black Girl's Guide to the PhD, as well as a contributing author of Lessons Learned, Stories from Women Leader in STEM. Malaika Grayson, welcome to Sound Practice.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, well, it's my absolute pleasure. Dr. Grayson, could you please describe your path that led you to earning a doctoral degree in mechanical engineering?
Yeah. You know, it's a very windy path, but always happy to share. I grew up in Trinidad and Tobago, so very much child of the island, loved it. And I grew up in a huge family. My mom has seven or eight siblings. My dad has 10 siblings. So very, very huge village, large village there. But growing up, I always actually wanted to be a doctor. At 5 years old, I said I would like to be a doctor. I want to become a doctor one day. My aunt, she was a nurse, and I really just enjoyed the learning from her. And I always said that. And as I got to high school, especially, biology just was not for me. I barely passed biology, and I realized I didn't enjoy it. And you know, you have to pick these core sciences, especially when you get to a certain point, to decide which direction you're going to go for college. Essentially, I leaned more towards physics because I realized I really enjoyed the mechanics of how things work, of how appliances worked, of how anything mechanical worked, and just the layers behind it, the systems engineering behind it. And ultimately, that led me to pursue a physics degree at Adelphi University in Long Island. And once I was there, you know, I was pure science, physics. And while I enjoyed that, I enjoyed the theory of everything, I really wanted to try to explore more. So I applied to a summer undergraduate research experience at Georgia Tech. And first time in Atlanta, first time in an institution that's really engineering focused, right? And it was just so eye-opening because the project that I worked on, I got to work in a lab with a graduate student mentor, research professor, and really enjoyed my project. I was there for 10 weeks. And by the time I left Georgia Tech, I wanted to do my PhD. And I wanted to apply for that PhD. So I, you know, applied to a bunch of places, trying to understand where would this physics background take me and what I was truly interested in. And that's how I ended up choosing mechanical engineering, because I felt like physics was a theory and mechanical engineering was the applied. And ultimately, I decided to go to Cornell University to pursue my PhD in mechanical engineering. And there is when I decided to pick a topic for my dissertation, which was wind energy. And I was motivated by growing up on the islands and renewable energy and understanding how we can bring that and use that to urban areas versus rural areas. So that's a little bit about that path there.
Well, very nice. Now, when I read some of the things that you've written, and it said that as a child, your favorite activity was taking apart the standing fan and putting it back together. And I often hear these kind of stories from engineers. Do you believe that some people are just predisposed to be an engineer?
You know, I think it's all about exposure. And if you grew up in a place where maybe people around you were doing things that align to engineering. So for example, if somebody's very handy around the house and you're observing that, then you're ultimately predisposed. So we talk a lot about exposure, especially when it comes to a K through 12, because that is where we will find that we want to grow that interest. And so sometimes we have children who do have that exposure at home, and that's great. So they understand what it means and what it means to be an engineer and what engineering is. And then we have programs that allow us to really try to get them interested very early on so that they go on that path. For me, it really was more of, and maybe it was because of doing chores around the house where I had to do it anyway, and I enjoyed doing it. And I've always been a curious person. So I think anybody who's curious and curious about learning more, that's going to happen. And I always ask the question, why? Well, the fan isn't working. Why? Or it's not giving enough air. Why? Maybe it's doozy. I don't know. Let's take it apart. Or this is making this noise. Why? I'm always trying to get to the root cause.
Very, very interesting. Now, you've mentioned in some of your work that you've benefited from mentors. Maybe talk a little bit about that. And what do you think makes a good mentor?
Yeah, that's a great question. Mentorship is key to anybody's success, I believe. You're not an island. You kind of do it on your own. You kind of become successful on your own. You put in the work, but at some point in your life, somebody was there to give you guidance and advice. And you may not have regarded them as a mentor, but they gave you advice, they gave you guidance, right? They helped you make decisions. Mentorship for me was extremely important, especially when it came to deciding the first no PhD. My graduate mentor, he was really helpful to me during Georgia Tech as I was going through that process and being very transparent. And I talk a lot about mentorship, and I talk about mentorship, advocacy, sponsorship, and the difference, right? And the fact that we should have all of those people in our network some way, somehow, understanding that mentorship, they evolve, the relationships evolve, the relationships are short, they're long, it depends on where you are in your life. And the reason why we want to make sure that we have mentors is because we need that person to really help guide us and tell us the hard truths sometimes, right? Because that's what mentorship is about. But you have to be receptive to listening, because it's also a commitment. And it's two commitments happening, but you are trying to get something out of it. So I would always tell, maybe those who I mentor, you need to know what you're trying to get out of this relationship. I know what I want to offer you, but that is based on what you are looking for, because we have mentors for different things. And then when I tell people about advocacy, it's figure out a way to really get the exposure and, of course, your brand, because you want to get to a place where somebody's advocating for you when you're not in a room and somebody's speaking your name when you can't and saying, yes, this person is perfect for this role. And then, of course, the sponsorship is that person who can make that decision and help you to the next level of your career. So I try to, when I use one term, use them all together, because they're all very important.
I agree. In Lessons Learned, Stories from Women in STEM, you write that women represented just 16% of engineers in the STEM workforce when you were at Cornell. Why was the percentage so low, and is it still at that level?
It's very easy to walk into a room and see that you're one of a few, and then wonder if you belong in the space. And this almost has a tie to not just mentorship and advocacy, but the support, right? I think there is a very, very real gap in allyship when it comes to, because 16% in the STEM workforce, but you have to believe more women are coming into the schools, right? So what happens between the entry at the institution and then when they get into the workforce, right? Why is there a leaky pipeline? So it goes back to root cause. Are they getting the support that they need at the universities? Are they enough? Is there enough representation when it comes to professors? And do we see that equity across the student population, especially for women, right? So I think all those are factors, and I know it has gotten better in the past year because of the sponsorship that we see from companies. Like, companies are being very vocal now about the fact that they are looking to really increase the representation at the companies as well as institutions, and being very outright in that. But you can get them in the door. How do you keep them? And I think that is where the focus needs to start being in terms of keeping women in STEM, making sure that they feel, because yes, you can hire me, but if the culture is still women don't belong here, or you know, we're not going to give you any work, or we're not going to promote you, or you're not going to get the support, then you're still going to have that leaky pipeline. It has just moved downstream.
Right. Well, you've been in both academia and in industry. Do the challenges women in STEM face in these two worlds differ?
They differ, but they're also similar. And I'll say why. So academia, it's the professors, when it comes to professors who are women, they're few, they're very few. I know when I was going through, it was a very small number, especially Black women. I don't know any, when I was going through my PhD program, there was no Black woman I could look to at that time. So that's one thing. But then you go into industry and your leadership, it's very much the same, right? White male. And so that's where I think they're similar, because when you look to your leadership, leadership isn't representative of who you are, whether it be gender or background, and or race. So that's where I think they're similar. I think the differences are, and I know academia has probably gotten better about this, but with industry, you can really kind of grow your network in that space. Of course, because you're either in a large company or you're cutting across industries, like different industrial partners, going to conferences as a professional. So you find that it's a little bit easier to grow your network, and you have that larger community. Academic communities are really small. And so that makes it a little bit difficult, because you're siloed, right, within your academic institution, unless you go to some academic conferences to engage with people. And I know for me, that was a little bit difficult. So I had a great community in my school, and that made me feel safe and happy. And that's really what got me through. And then come to industry, and I'm just able to create networks as I go across the company and find mentors and seek out people within that industry who look like me, right? Or women, definitely more women leaders, even though the leadership is still very much leaning towards male, you still have the opportunity to find people who you can look to.
Dr. Grayson, I see that you speak nationally on a number of subjects, including canceling imposter syndrome. And I've got two questions on this. Is imposter syndrome a significant problem for women in STEM? And how do you go about canceling it?
Yeah, I guess it depends on who you ask, right? But I do believe it's based on a number of factors. It's based on your culture, your environment, maybe the community that you're around. So I say that, and I can use myself as an example. Culture. If you grew up and in the Caribbean culture or many of the cultures, you are expected to do well in school. You're expected to, it's A plus or A, 100 points and nothing else, right? That's what we celebrate. And that's just because of the culture. That's how our parents grew up. They grew up where you work hard, you do very well in school because that's what's recognized, because that's what's going to get you there. And so naturally, you get into a place where you're not competing, but you're kind of competing, and you get like a lower grade, for example. You feel as if you have to deliver, and maybe you are actually doing the best that you can, and you're comparing yourself to others like, oh, well, I'm not getting this A plus, so I'm not getting this anymore, so I don't belong here, right? So that's what I mean. It's kind of the culture. And then of course the environment. If people are looking, oh, maybe their microaggressions, like you don't belong here, and it's really more their lack of exposure, then you start to internalize that as, maybe I don't, because, you know, I walk into this room and I don't see somebody who looks like me. I don't see another woman. So is this not a space for us? And so there are all these different factors that play into that.
You also speak on the dream effect. Could you please describe what the dream effect is?
Yeah. So that's something new that I've been talking about. And it's really about how do we take what we feel as impossible and turn it into probable by using some mindset shifts like determination, right? Being energetic. So really focusing on your energy on what is my end goal? What is my end state? What is the other one? I haven't written down because I haven't done it in so long. Yeah, M is about mind. So I have everything as an acronym for me. So like imposter syndrome, it's through victory. And then dream effect. So the M is about like your mindset shifting. And it's really trying to, when we approach something, not automatically think of it as this is impossible, but breaking it down to see what parts of it seem impossible. And is there something that I should be doing so that the pieces, right? Maybe a piece of this may seem impossible now, but the others are quite probable. They can be done. And then figuring out how do I change my mindset or how do I change the approach and what needs to happen for me to be successful in what feels like the impossible.
I'm interested in your work on building geometry's impact upon when. This may be something that you haven't thought about in a while, but it seemed very interesting to me. Could you just tell me a little bit about it, about your work?
Yeah. So that was my dissertation topic, and it's definitely been a while, but the idea is that if we were to rely solely on renewable energy, or we have places that do rely on renewable energy. Texas is a good example, right? They have their grid and then they have wind turbines, so they use them interchangeably, but or together. The idea is that what if we didn't have to put these turbines all the way out in rural areas, right? Because when you have to travel through the grid and all these things, you're losing time, probably losing some type of efficiency. And if we were able to scale down those turbines a little bit and put them in urban areas on the tops of building, right? Because the reason they're in rural areas is because you are surrounded by just land. So the obstruction is less, and that means the turbulence is less, and you want smooth, undisrupted wind to hit your turbine so that you can get it spinning. And in urban areas, you don't have that because you have structures all over the place. So they naturally create turbulence as the wind is going through, but they also naturally create some wind tunnel effect. If you've never been through two buildings and that wind is hitting you, that's the wind tunnel effect. And what if we were able to take advantage of the skyscrapers, the tall buildings that we have, and put a turbine, a small scale turbine, so nothing like we usually see, on the edge, on the roof of the building, so that as that smooth wind above all these structures is coming in and hitting, it starts spinning. And that, of course, you once it gets that, it's into kinetic energy, into electrical, and the physics behind it. And the building itself is probably able to have its own electricity, right? So that is the idea. And if it's something that is working enough, maybe it's an opportunity for it to even share with a building next to it. And so that is the concept behind that urban wind dissertation and my urban wind work, is trying to lean more into the renewable energy and showing that, okay, it's not just associated with rural areas, but if we really thought about how we design a building to mimic that smooth wind, so maybe it's a slanted building and looked at different building shapes, how do we speed up the wind, right? Because the energy, the wind power that you get, it's a function of the wind speed as well. So how do we speed it up? So is it that we put the building at an angle, or we funnel it all through like that wind tunnel effect?
That's fascinating. Thank you for explaining that to me. Dr. Grayson, is our time together wraps up. I'm sure that in our audience today, there are some individuals that would like to engage with you. Could you describe the services you offer and how people could reach you?
Yeah, so we talked about a few of those topics today. We talked about canceling imposter syndrome through VICTORY. That's the acronym. So I'll just touch a little bit on visualizing your goal, realizing the R is realizing that what you're feeling is a feeling and not fact, and talking about it and looking at opportunities. So that's one of the topics, of course. I talk about my journey through STEM. I just started a new one that's basically called Connections Unveiled, leveraging your brand to activate your career network, as well as career vision boarding. So those are a couple of new topics. And then some of the more signature ones, are older ones like the Dream Effect and things like that. So I talk about a number of topics. They're based on my experiences, based on what I've learned, the things that I've come up with, like the connection map. And if people are interested, I do keynotes. I sit on panels, a lot of workshops. So I partner with not just institutions, but also companies if they would like to do a workshop. And they can check me out on my website, and it's www.malikagrayson.com. So just one word, MalikaGrayson.com. And they can also find me on LinkedIn, and that's just Malika Grayson if they search, and Instagram, which is Dr. Malika Grayson.
My guest has been Dr. Malika Grayson. Thank you so much for being on Sound Practice.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My thanks to Dr. Malika Grayson for her time and insights. Her career path and writings will inspire future leaders. My thanks also to the American Association for Physician Leadership for making this podcast possible. Please join me next time on Sound Practice. We release a new episode every other Wednesday.
You've been listening to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders. Check out the show notes for this episode at soundpracticepodcast.com. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear them. Email us at info@soundpracticepodcast.com. Subscribe to Sound Practice wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically receive our episodes. And please rate us and comment on the podcast in iTunes and Google Play. Sound Practice is presented and produced by the team at American Association for Physician Leadership. We are the world's premier organization for all aspects of physician leadership in every sector of healthcare. Learn more at physicianleaders.org. Holy cow, Batman and Robin, Whitman Kapow.